Thank you, Mr. Moore and family. Brethren, let's go over to 1 John 4. 1 John 4. There just is no greater love. Tim Keller wrote the following: "You're likely far more sinful than you ever thought you were. However, you are more loved than you ever dreamed you could be." You know, in our age today, it's probably pretty difficult for all of us to understand such a great love as God has. It's even more difficult, I think, to experience it because of our divided society and the way we're raised and the families that we come from are sometimes split up, sometimes often fighting, that kind of thing. And just as human beings, our feelings, our moods, transitory words and feelings make our love sometimes very fickle. And love can be deeply meaningful between individuals, human beings, but it can be fickle. For example, Mary broke up with her boyfriend for another man. Later she wrote this old boyfriend saying this: "No words could ever express the great unhappiness I've felt since breaking our engagement. Please say you'll take me back. No one could ever take your place in my heart. So please forgive me. I love you. I love you. I love you. Yours forever, Marie. P.S. Congratulations on winning the state lottery." You know, my point today is this: what most people think about love, or what they think is love, really isn't. Many think it's just a feeling of wanting another, and they think that's love. Another, it's infatuation, and they think that's love. It's appreciation for somebody, or enjoying another. The truth is, it's far greater than that. Love is, true love is, it's caring about something or someone equal to or greater than ourselves. And God is the author of love. He's the embodiment of that love. He is the definition of love. In that context, I wish deeply that I was smarter. I wish deeply that I was more spiritual. And I wish deeply that I was a better communicator. And the reason is because what I want to talk about today is the love of God. And I feel so insignificant and so inadequate and so weak in this area. And yet I feel the need to talk about it. And I ask forgiveness for my limited abilities in this regard. 1 John 4 and verse 8. God is love. It says this: "He that loves not knows not God, for God is love." And let's go over to Romans 1 for a moment. Romans 1. So I'm asking us to think about this subject today. You know, the scriptures tell us that wisdom cries out in the streets. Wisdom is there, and everywhere we look, we see that creation is speaking to us about God. And it's telling us, really, if we're listening, if we're tuned in, it's telling us about his love. Romans 1 and verse 20: "For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." And that's why I say everywhere you look in the creation, what you see is the love of God staring back at us. And I ask you to think about this. Thousands of years ago, God created this earth, and he designed it to be a unique creation, and he was going to make a man. So he created the sky, and he created it to be a beautiful color of blue. And there has to be certain elements in that air to make us see blue. And it's because it's a soothing color. And then he accented it with white clouds and sometimes a beautiful sunset. But you understand, that was planned out. That was designed for us. Everything in the creation is designed for us. All to carry, in the case of the atmosphere, the oxygen to his creation. Then he created thousands of beautiful trees. I looked some of this up, but I didn't want to present a list that went on and on and on. But there are 400,000 kinds of flowers. And I remember going down to Tahiti when I was a young man. And down there, there's a green that you probably haven't seen before. There's the deepest, richest green. And in the midst of it, orchids off trees everywhere. Just beautiful, beautiful colors. And things that to look at that are pleasing all for us. You know, there's all the hundreds of different rich grasses, you know, and there is the majestic snow-capped mountains, and I think it's so amazing the closer you get to God's creation, the more impressive it is. And when you think about a snowflake, each single one different from any other, and then when you see the sun sometimes comes out on the snow, and it looks like acres of diamonds everywhere. It's just beautiful, isn't it? It is, and it was made that way on purpose. Not for God. It was made that way for us so that we could see it, so that we could enjoy it. And then you look at the mountains, and as we did here, we saw that those mountains are enormous caves. There's lakes, there's rivers, and there's acres of granite and marble and gems, beautiful stones. And those were all made for us to have as jewelry for our homes and for ourselves. Beautiful gifts that God has given us. Beautiful rolling green hills and lakes like the Lake of the Ozarks, just spotted and dotted all over his creation. And beautiful kind of simmering streams that flow down into the valleys. All of that is just so wonderful. And all look at all the different animals he created and how unique all of they are, you know. Amazing butterflies, just unbelievable number of them. And I remember seeing the monarch butterfly and how many thousands of miles it travels and how beautiful that butterfly is. And the whole story of the monarch is actually just representing God's plan where it makes a cocoon and then it dissolves and a new life comes out, one that's beautiful and can fly instead of just a worm eating to satisfy itself. Yes, it's amazing. Foods of every kind. You know, at the feast we enjoy steak, we enjoy salads, vegetables, fish, all of that. It's a good thing the feast is short. Because if we were any longer, we'd be fulfilling scriptures. There were giants in those days. Yeah. Foods of every kind of delicious desserts made from God's creation today. Textures, colors, flavors are wonderful. All of this thoughtfully planned out and prepared and created for mankind everywhere. Doesn't it show the love of God for us when you look at his creation? Psalm 139. Need a bigger podium next time. Psalm 139. You know, the creation is not just showing off. It's not God just showing off his creative abilities. He's showing us how much he loves us. It was all made for our pleasure. All made for our pleasure. And it was his gift to the creation that he would make. Because as yet, when he recreated the earth, he had not made a man. And so God created all things instantly. All those other things that he made, all those things we talked about, he made by command of his voice. But now there was something different that was going to take place. He was going to make a man, and what he did next was intensely and deeply personal. He took his own hands and dipped them into the soil, and he fashioned that soil into a physical replica of himself. And then he began to form man, and after finishing, he looked on it, I'm sure, affectionately, and he placed his mouth over the lips and the mouth of his creation, and he breathed the breath of life into his creation. And it was such an intimate moment for him. Mankind was born. Mankind was born. And he is the most incredible creation of all of God's creation. David wrote of this, in his own creation at least, in 139, verse 14. I will praise you, he says, for I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows right well. My substance was not hid from you when I was made in secret, curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect. And in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned when as yet there were none of them. Just consider how incredible our bodies are for a moment. You have the ears that can hear, and you can hear incredibly beautiful sounds that are sounds from the chirping birds, but there's also incredible music and concerts and the creations that we can make with sounds. And we're able to hear those things so beautifully. And the eye and what it's able to do to look at the vibrant colors, the textures and movement. And the hand, we have so much dexterity, and there's so many muscles pulling on tendons so that we can do this, so we can snap our fingers, so that we can be working on delicate things that we're creating. All of that thought out in advance, all of that planned, all of that designed, and then all of that created by the Almighty God so that we could enjoy this body that He's giving us. And I ask you to think about probably the most important aspect of a human being, and that is the brain. And here's what the National Geographic writes. Making sense of the brain's mind-boggling complexity just isn't easy. What we do know is that it's the organ that makes us human, giving people the capacity for art, for language, moral judgments, and rational thought. It's also responsible for each individual's personality, memories, movements, and how we sense the world. All this comes from a jelly-like mass of fat and protein weighing about 3 pounds. It is nevertheless one of the body's biggest organs, consisting of some 100 billion nerve cells that not only put together thoughts and highly coordinated physical actions, but regulate our unconscious body processes such as digestion and breathing. It's an amazing thing. Now, I don't know what the comparison would be like today, but when I was younger, or maybe 5-10 years ago, and did some study on this subject of the brain, I remember they were making an analogy, and they said that to make a computer that would be able to do what our brain does in that day, they said that it would be a computer the size of Texas and a mile high. That would be some computer. But you understand, there's just incredible things that are happening in our brain and the senses that are coming in that we hear and we see and we've tasted, and all of that is happening, and there's just incredible feedback, and all kinds of signals are being set and recognized and patterns understood in the brain. Amazing thing that He's done. And I ask you to think, being made in God's image, isn't that a profound gift that He's given us? We could have been made in another image, any kind of image, but He made us in His own image, and that is so personal and so intimate and shows so much love. It's an amazing thing. All that we have, all that we are, all came from Him. And it was for us and for us to enjoy. 1 John 3. God also created us to be able to experience love, His love. And one of the ways that love is reflected is in the family. And He loves us as sons, as daughters. And so He says this in verse 1. Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us, that we should be called the sons of God. Therefore the world knows us not, because it knew Him not. Do we get any sense of this? You know, what manner of love it is that we could be His sons. Beloved, now we are the sons of God, but it doesn't yet appear what we shall be. But we know that when we shall appear, we'll be like him. We'll see him as he is. Now we're the sons of God, and it does not yet appear what we will be like. And that's a point I want to make later on today. And I want you to hold that thought. Right now, we can experience the love of God by looking at the creation and looking how he made us and looking how he made the creation to please us. We can see the love of God by the creation. There's no question about that. But I ask you to think about this. How can you understand the love of God unless you are like him? Do you understand what's coming? Something beyond our imagination, something beyond our ability to conceive of it. We're going to be like him. And only then can we really share the love that he has for us. Not just look and go, boy, he must really care because look how he did this and this is fun and this is so nice. There's so much that he's given us. Luke 15. So what I'm getting at here is that, you know, we can see the love of God in the family, but here we are at the end of the age when families are so destroyed, when there isn't the kind of love, the kind of experience that God always intended. It's not here anymore. Tragically, family love has been so distorted today that we can't see God's intention here. And Satan has divided families. Mothers are often forced to work in our society today. In many cases, children are now raised by the school systems. You know, Satan has created also a generation gap. I remember I went to Guyana. They have no generation gap there. We had the feast down in Guyana, and what would happen is the adults would be talking there together, and we'd be talking about things, and the kids would come up, and they would stand around, and they'd look up at the parents because they wanted to know and learn how to be a grown-up. And so they would listen intently. But today here, the advertising industry has made magazines for the kids, special clothes for the kids. They have their own music. And all of that is on for a purpose, to divide us in family. That's the purpose, Satan's purpose. So we don't feel the family love. We don't feel the parental love today the way God intended. And I'm so tragically a creation of that mess, you know, myself. And so I understand it. And I know there's others here that experience it too. Being abandoned by family or unloved by family or in a fighting, angry, hostile environment. So my point is this. There's little bond of love in family today. And so I can't use today as an example, but I want to go over and talk about the prodigal son just for a moment, because there I think Christ gives us an image of the kind of family love that should exist. So, the prodigal son was, of course, wanted to take his inheritance early, and his father gave it to him, and he went out and lived with riotous living like many of us did before we were called. And then he finally came upon hard times, and he thought, well, I'll go back to my father and beg him to let me work as his servant. And so we pick it up here in Luke 15 and verse 20. Luke 15 and verse 20, and he arose, and he came to his father. But when he was yet a great way off, his father saw him, and he had compassion and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and in your sight, and I'm no more worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, bring forth the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet. And bring here the fatted calf and kill it, and let's eat and be merry. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and he's found. And they began to be merry. And so what we read here is that the father saw the son coming toward the house from far away. And I say this, he would have, in the story, he would have likely been looking down that road probably almost every day in hope. Maybe someday I'll see him come back. That's the kind of love that God has. And rather than criticize him, the Father welcomed him with joy. And I think Christ tells this story so that we can understand how the Father receives us when we repent. There isn't one of us that doesn't get off the path from time to time in our own way. But then we are sometimes afraid to go back to God because, oh, we've done wrong and we know we've done wrong, and we kind of, you know, kind of keep a little distance for a while. But my point is, do you understand the love of God? He's not mad that you're coming back to him. That's what he wants you to do. Come back. Come back to him so he can love us. So he loves us so much that he forgives us completely. He actually has the ability to put the memory of those sins out of his mind so that they don't come back. And I know each one of us have made mistakes in our lives. Every one of us have made mistakes. There's things that I bet every one of us can say, you know, I'm really ashamed of this or that thing that I did or was or whatever. But those mistakes do not come close to ever diminishing the Father's love for us. Okay? His love is unconditional, but that doesn't mean we always abide in it. You understand? There's some confusion on this, and some people get mushy on this, and I just would clarify with a statement or two. His love is unconditional because that's what he is. He's not going to stop being what he is because we sin. Okay? He still is love. But if you keep my commandments, you abide in my love. So you see my point. We can be outside of that so that we don't experience it. We don't feel it sometimes. But it's always there. And it's always waiting for us to come back like the prodigal son. And so I say this. When we do make mistakes, if we do sin, don't wait. Go right back as soon as possible. And he'll receive you, just as he receives all of us. So he's not going to give us a stone when we ask for bread. He's not going to give us a snake when we ask for a fish. He's going to give us what we need. He loves us, and he is going to give us what is in our best interest. Isaiah 49. On another level, I want us to think, instead of a father's love, I want us to think of a mother's love. Isaiah 29. Do you ever watch a new mother? I remember seeing this when I was first came into church. I didn't have much of a social life until then. When I came into church, I remember seeing some of the mothers, and they would have these their children, and they would coo over them, and they would giggle with them, and they would laugh with them, and you could just see the mother beaming with love. And there is that kind of love that we have because that's the kind of love the Father has. And so it is. You can see these new mothers with kind of enormous pride, you might say, love that they have. The baby that they have becomes their entire world. That's what they're all about. Do you think it's any less with God? No. We are his entire world. That's why there is a world. That's why there is a universe. We are his entire world and what he cares about. We're primary to everything, just like a baby is to its mother. Isaiah 49, verse 15. Sorry. Did I say that? 49. Can a woman forget her suckling child, that she should not have compassion on the son of her womb? Yes, they may forget, yet I will not forget you. God's love is completely selfless towards us. And I think a story illustrates this. I read this years ago, and I remember it to this day. One lady was driving with her child in the back in the car seat, and she hit a slippery curve and went off the road into a stream. She careened off that bridge, And her car began to sink, and the water pressure was too great for her to open the door, and it was seeping in. And she knew, as it seeped in, she and her baby were doomed. Then the rescue team arrived very quickly, and the men broke open the car. There they found the mother sitting lifeless in the driver's seat. And as the water rose, she had been able to unstrap her child from the seat, and she propped the baby up to the headliner using her arms through the headrest to hold that baby up in hopes that a few more minutes of time that baby could be saved. And they found that baby, and the baby was alive. But that's a mother's love, and that was the love that God had for us. John 3, like a loving parent, there is nothing that God would not do for us. And his love is self-sacrificing. And this is a truth that we, you and me, we must never, ever forget. God loved us more than we can imagine. And I ask, well, just how much is that love? And here's what it says in John 3 and verse 16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. And so here we see God willing to give the thing he loved most for all of us. And you can't deny that kind of love. You can't even begin to think of it. It was February 16th, 1989. The lives of George and Vera were changed forever. The phone rang about 9:15, as the story goes, and they were told there was an accident involving their son down by the high school. So they drove to the scene immediately. As they approached the intersection near the high school, they could see the lights flashing from the police cars, from the ambulance, and so on. Vera noticed the direction of the photographer's camera, and it led to a large pool of blood, the largest she thought she had ever seen. All she could say is, Ben, her son Ben, is gone. Our son Ben is crushed. And her first reaction was to jump out of the car and collect the blood. She wanted to put it back into her son. That moment, his blood became the most precious thing in the world because it was his life. That blood belonged to her son, she thought. The road was dirty, and that blood did not belong on that dirty road. And cars were trying to get through the intersection, and some of them actually ran over some of the blood before they could clear a space there. And the father, he wanted to put his coat over it and cover it up and protect it. But it was at that moment that Vera understood something of great and beautiful that is truth. Christ's blood was the strongest language God could use. The strongest language he could use because it was the most precious and the highest price that he could pay. And I think we've got to understand this and understand it individually, how much he loved us and how much he cared about us to make that kind of a statement to us. He could have waved a magic wand. He could have done anything, but he's proven to you the love he has. And there'll never be a question about that through all of eternity. This is so important. No one ever loved you that much. Nobody has ever sacrificed that much for you. And I want us to understand it. This is the love of God. Not for them. Not for the world, you know, in general, you, me. That's the kind of love he had for each one of us. It's so beautiful. It's overwhelming when you think about it. This is the depth of God's love, that he would allow himself to be torn apart for us, that he would allow himself to be humiliated and spit on and slapped and hit, and that he would have a crown of thorns put on him, and that he would have the filth of our sins put on him, who was holy and pure. That's so incredibly profound in the love that he has for you and for me. Okay. There is no greater love than his love. He gave Christ as a sacrifice for us. And he did that for a reason. And the reason was so that he could then have us repent and he could send the seed of his Spirit. And that seed would be something that would grow in us. And it would grow in us until we were finally born again. And we experienced birth. In that context, I want to show just a brief 15-minute video today, The Birth of a Child. It shows us the care that God has for us. It shows the intricacy of the details that he paid attention to as he created the creation of mankind. But it also does something else. It is an incredible portrait of God's plan for us and our ultimate end. And so I want to show this video for a few moments.
Look around at nature, from a tiny algae to a sunflower, to the stars and the Milky Way, we can see intricate patterns that are breathtaking in their beauty. Even more astonishing is how these amazingly complex systems work together to support a function like life. In man-made things, we see systems that are engineered with a specific purpose in mind. But can this be true in nature as well? Are there systems that allow birds to fly, whales to swim, or flowers to bloom, also the result of intentional design? And what about the human body? In all its beauty, performance, and complexity, the human body is compelling evidence that God made us in his own image to serve his purpose. We believe the Bible plainly says that God specifically created us. It's pretty hard to look at the diverse, unique world around us without sensing there must be a master designer responsible for it all. To think otherwise simply defies what we can clearly see. In fact, God promised that we could see the evidence. Romans 1:20 tells us that, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made." Creation. Made. Notice those words. God used the language of design and construction. This series takes us on a journey through the most complex and miraculous creations on earth. Us. Physicians, scientists, engineers, and other experts will guide us on an exploration of some of the most intricate and amazing features of the human body. We'll also meet the Millers, Mark and Dana, and their two children, Johnny and Audrey. They represent a typical American family, active in their church and community. Like most of us, they rarely stop to think just how truly extraordinary the very fact of their existence really is. As we watch the Miller family grow and learn, they'll help us illustrate the miracle of childbirth and the blessing of eyesight. They'll demonstrate how using our hands for the most simple daily tasks is far more complicated than even the greatest feats of human engineering. And we'll learn how the systems of our body make it possible for us to live and breathe and accomplish extraordinary things that only humans can do. We are God's intentional creation, and He has a purpose in mind for each of us. So, let's get started and find out how awesome our created bodies really are. How can you tell the difference between something that is designed versus something that came together naturally? Like the pattern of fallen leaves or clouds in the sky. Things that are designed will show one or more of seven patterns common to designed things. First, designed things, whatever they are, will have numerous parts working together to fulfill a specific purpose or function. The more interconnected parts there are, the more complicated it becomes. It's like a puzzle. The more pieces it has, the more complex it is. A second principle of design is a particular arrangement of the parts. For a thing to work as a whole, all the parts must be present and must be specifically arranged. The only way to get the whole picture is for all the puzzle pieces to fit together in the right arrangement. The more pieces there are, however, the more chances there are to get the arrangement wrong. In that case, the thing doesn't do what it's designed to do. Out of countless wrong possibilities, there's really only one way for this puzzle to work as intended. The human body works in a similar way. When you have all the parts properly arranged, then the system can fulfill its function, whether that's sight, touch, or the ability to put this puzzle together. Characteristics of design that always come from the mind of an intelligent designer. Let's compare it to something that we can all relate to, a bicycle. Now, most of us learned to ride a bicycle when we were just kids, so we probably haven't really stopped to think about what a cool product of engineering it is. But the way a bicycle is designed takes advantage of physics along with the structure and energy potential of our bodies, and it all comes together with the purpose of getting us from one place to another. In addition to having purpose and a specific arrangement of parts, a bicycle will also feature these additional design requirements. Number three, proper alignment. If the wheels aren't in alignment with the frame, your bike will wobble and your tires will rub up against the frame. Number four is precise timing. If the gears don't fit into the chain at just the right time, you won't get any forward movement. Characteristic number five is exact dimensions and shape. The frame is structured to distribute the rider's weight evenly between front and back wheels. And of course, the circular shape of the tires and the wheels is what makes it work. Number six is a tight fit. If you've ever had a chain on your bike loosen up or the gear slip, you'll find it requires much more energy to ride it, or you can't ride it at all. And finally, characteristic number seven is a definite sequence for correct assembly. You can't put the wheels on before the frame is built. Design requirements, you'd probably get a bike that's poorly cobbled together and probably doesn't work at all. An easy way to think about the patterns of design is by their operation. Purpose and design are inseparable. You know, an architect wouldn't try to design a building without first knowing its purpose. Plans and specifications always are a sign of conscious design. When you see the patterns of design, you know they come from an intelligent designer. So, shouldn't we come to the same conclusion when we see these same features in living things? Let's keep these seven principles in mind as we explore the human body. Our journey begins with an event so common, yet so profound. The birth of a baby. Human development element is a perfect example of multiple parts working together for a purpose. It illustrates a principle called all or nothing unity.
In living organisms, all or nothing unity means that unless all of the critical parts are in the right place, at the right time, and in the right amount, none of the expected function is attained. It never implies that every part is absolutely essential. For instance, we can live without an appendix, but you certainly can't live without your brain, and you certainly can't live without your heart. So we need all of those parts together, or you do not get the function that was originally planned for that system. But with reproduction, you have to have all of the parts from mom and dad and baby in at the right place at the right time, or nothing can reproduce. And if you can't reproduce, you do not get a second generation to get it right. And you know, the Bible was pretty insightful when it mentioned way back in Genesis chapter 1 about living things whose seed was in itself.
Childbirth is so common, it's easy to overlook the fact that before a baby ever arrives in the nursery, he thrives in a total water world for 9 months, a world that is impossible for any person to live in once he has taken his very first breath. To accomplish that feat, only while the baby is in the womb, his body has special characteristics that make him uniquely suited to live and grow in a watery world. How does this happen? Let's flash back in time to when Mark and Dana Miller were expecting their first child, Johnny. Mrs. Miller can expect a lot of changes to her body over the next few months as their baby develops. During pregnancy, the arteries and veins of a mother and her baby must somehow connect to ensure that the baby receives all the sustenance he needs to grow. But as the baby nears birth, intricate and systematic changes to the baby's blood vessels and heart must happen so he can live and breathe. God achieved this by designing the placenta, a remarkable temporary organ that provides a magnificent interface system between two distinct biological entities that safely bridges mom to her baby.
Before we are born, we obtain all the nutrients and oxygen we need to grow and to develop from the mother's body through the placenta. But then marvelous changes happen. Moments after birth, we can only obtain air by breathing through the lungs. So how does this happen, the change from the watery world to that outside, a completely different world outside of the mother's womb? Well, to understand this and answer this question, we have to compare the circulatory system of the unborn baby to that of the mother.
Blood makes its way to nearly every part of the body via the circulatory system. Its main feature is the heart, that on a really simple level is a pump. With every beat, your heart contracts, pushing blood out and circulating it throughout your body, including your lungs, where it picks up a fresh supply of oxygen. Did you know your body has nearly 60,000 miles of blood vessels? Your heart beats about 100,000 times a day, or about 36 million times per year. Your body contains about 5 quarts of blood, which circulate through the body on average one time per minute. Without this process happening every minute of every day of our entire lives, we cannot live. But before a baby is born, he lives inside his mother's body in water. So what's different for the baby in the womb?
First, the baby must have a substitute lung. The placenta, which is a temporary organ that develops during pregnancy, fulfills this and many other functions. Second, the circuit to the lungs must have a bypass, a connection between the artery that supplies blood to the body, the aorta, and the artery that carries blood to the lungs, the pulmonary artery, is called the ductus arteriosus. The ductus arteriosus is that bypass around the lungs. Third, the blood vessels must not only connect the placenta to the baby, but also they have to connect inside the baby from the point of attachment to permanent vessels that lead to and from the heart. The umbilical cord is the connection between the placenta and the unborn baby. It provides a bypass around the liver so that the oxygen and nutrient-rich blood can have the most direct route to the heart and brain.
What this all means is that because an unborn baby is not ready to breathe air, only about 10% blood volume circulates through the lungs, which is just the right amount for the lungs to develop. There are also two other temporary routes that bypass the liver and provide a shortcut between the right and left sides of the baby's heart. The purpose of these detours is to get the main flow of oxygen-enriched blood directly and efficiently to the places where it is needed most, primarily the developing brain and heart. What's really amazing is that in the baby, unlike in the adult, the oxygen-rich blood and the oxygen-poor blood actually merge together in the same vein. It's a bit like two streams that flow into the same riverbed, running side by side, but without mixing a lot. Certain design features within the system function to control this blood flow in order to get the right amount of oxygen to the right places while the baby grows and develops. For about 9 months, the baby is pretty content in the underwater world of the womb. But then, everything changes. When Mrs. Miller starts to go into labor, the baby's world is set to radically change. Of course, God, the master designer, planned for that. He created the temporary structures in a way that provides the baby a safe transition out of the womb and into our world.
As the time of birth draws near, the mother and child must go through great changes to prepare the baby for life on the outside to breathe air. By the end of the 7th month, special cells in the lungs are secreting a certain substance which helps to open up the lungs and keep them open when the time comes.
So when it's time for the baby to be born, how does his little body know to take his first breath?
There's these special detectors inside the umbilical cord which are especially sensitive to stresses. And they send signals to tiny little muscles surrounding the vessels, causing them to constrict and to clamp down, which limits the flow of blood from placenta to baby, causing an increase in the level of carbon dioxide. These special sensors inside a baby's body are able to detect that increase in carbon dioxide and sends a signal to baby's brain, which is then sent to baby's lungs, saying, take a breath, take a breath. And of course, after that cord is cut and that flow of oxygen stops, that carbon dioxide level increases, sending that irresistible urge for baby to take its very first breath.
Johnny's first breath starts irreversible changes for his life in a new world. In the one critical minute after delivery, his body initiates structural changes that make him able to survive in a radically different environment.
Once the baby's lungs are inflated, the pressures necessary to pump blood through the lungs drop 90% from the levels they were in the womb. The pressure in the right side of the heart immediately drops well below the pressure in the left side. This pressure change shuts the trap door between the right and left sides of the heart. Later on, cells begin to grow over the edges of the valve, permanently closing up the temporary opening. Less than a minute after birth, the cessation of flow through the umbilical vein and arteries and the higher levels of oxygen in the blood triggering certain chemical reactions close down the umbilical vein and arteries and the bypass around the liver. The very same factor that helps cause the arteries in the lungs to open up also helps cause the bypass around the lungs to close down, and rather quickly. That is the increase in oxygen levels with the onset of breathing. The other main factor in closing down the bypass around the lungs is the lack of that molecule produced in the placenta caused by clamping of the umbilical cord. Its job is to keep the bypass open until delivery has been accomplished.
When Johnny takes his first breath, blood starts flowing along the new circuit where it picks up fresh oxygen. Within 30 minutes, all temporary bypasses, including the trap door between the right and left sides of the heart, close up. Within 1 or 2 days, the bypasses are closed for good. Johnny has successfully transitioned out of his 9-month temporary water world to his new and permanent air-filled home. The way the circulatory system of the unborn baby is able to swiftly transform itself to purposefully suit the newborn baby displays all the characteristics of an intentional and well-designed system. Numerous parts with precise dimensions and a particular arrangement working together for a specific purpose with a definite sequence and precise timing. That kind of complexity doesn't happen by accident.
Fortunately, for the vast majority of births, things proceed along normally. And within 1 or 2 days, all of those functional anatomical differences between baby and mom are essentially closed, and baby is well on its way towards living this fully functional life, growing from a child to an adult.
Of course, we want all babies to be born in perfect health. But unfortunately, this isn't always the case. Some babies are born with health problems that may stay with them for life. But regardless of the baby's health, every birth is a miracle and a blessing. As the psalmist says in Psalm 127, 3 and 5, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. It is simply amazing. The very structures that are absolutely essential for a baby to live and develop inside the womb are absolutely incompatible with life outside the womb. Think about it from a design perspective. To get a heart transplanted from one person to live inside someone else is a truly incredible technological achievement. It takes a room full of sophisticated equipment and highly trained doctors. Imagine then what kind of master engineer it took to design a system in which a whole person lives inside another person for 9 months. Childbirth is so common, but so mind-blowing when you really think about it. Mothers and babies' independent systems fit together perfectly to sustain the baby as his body develops itself in the womb. And then a series of miraculous changes happen. The intertwined systems delicately unravel and the baby is born. What can be more astonishing than that? In the miracle of reproduction, God shows evidence of his presence and his plans for us. As the psalmist proclaims to God in Psalm 139, 15 through 16, my frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret. Your eyes saw my substance being yet unformed, and in your book they all were written, the days fashioned for me.
What a remarkable technological achievement. Human engineers can only dream of coming up with something where a person could live inside another person, an entire watery world, and have everything change in one single breath. Now, I'm just astounded by that. It allows me to fall in love with the Lord in a much deeper way. The Bible says that the Lord knows us long before we're ever born. And it also indicates that he's very interested in our development. It says in Psalm 139 that he has covered us inside our mother's womb, which means he sees what's happening. He's controlling and he's guiding in that. And now we've had a look at what actually took place while that was happening inside of mom. Then why shouldn't we respond just like David did, who said, I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made, and that my soul knows very well.
That a baby in the womb can undergo such miraculous and rapid changes to live in our world is surely evidence of God's special love for us and must certainly indicate that he has a special purpose for us.
It's his spirit, and it's that that tethers us to him, and it's that by which he feeds us as we grow. So this video, to me, shows the love of God and his creation. I want you to go to John 16, if you would. But it reveals some really, I think, beautiful things that are the invisible things of God. And so much insight into what God is doing with you and with me. After Christ's sacrifice, he ascended to heaven. And there he sent his spirit to mankind. And that spirit is called a seed in the scriptures. And that seed grows in us. And we will become what grows inside each one of us. We are a spiritual life form inside a physical life form. That's what's taking place right now. It is Christ in you, the hope of glory. It is, in Christ's words, I in you and you in me. It is Paul's statement, Christ lives in me. There is another life form that is partly us, but it is what God is creating in us through the seed that he's planted in us. What is growing in us is an entirely new creature. And it's just like, in one sense, the embryo that is inside the mother's womb. The mother loves the embryonic child, loves it. And her body nourishes that baby, and it keeps it alive, and it keeps it healthy. But the child does not yet really experience personally, individually, that mother's love. You see the comparison? Once the child is born, it experiences a whole new dimension, a whole new world, and in that world it can experience the mother's love. It's a whole new reality. And so after that birth, now the child has a relationship with the mother that is one of unconditional love. See, but when it's growing inside, it can't feel it. It's interesting to me how it works. So the child does not experience the reality of her love until it's born. And we're like that with God. As a human, we can't fully experience the love of God. Oh yeah, we see it around us. We see it in the way he created us. We see all the wonderful things that are gifts that he gave to us, and the flowers and the animals and the food and all that it is there. And as Solomon said, the love of a man and a woman. What an incredible thing that is. A gift from God. Yes, it's amazing. But we can't fully, and we don't fully experience yet the love of God. We see it out there. We can make the conclusion, but we don't experience it. Just like the baby doesn't experience the unconditional love of the mother as she coos and plays and loves and beams with love for her child. That has to come after the baby's born. And that will come for us with the Father when we are finally born again. Okay, so we're like that mother, and we can only have a full embodiment of the love of God and experience that when we're born again, when we are like him, when we're on his level and living in his dimension. Only then will we fully know the love of God. We'll be born, we'll see the Father, we'll speak with him, and he with us. In John 16, verse 23, and in that day, that is after the resurrection, you'll ask me nothing. Truly, truly, I say unto you, whatsoever you ask the Father in my name, he'll give it to you. Hitherto, you've asked nothing in my name. Ask and you shall receive, that your joy may be full. And these things have I spoken unto you in Proverbs, but the time comes when I'll no more speak to you in Proverbs, but I will show you plainly of the Father. At that day you shall ask in my name, and I say not unto you that I will pray the Father for you, for the Father himself loves you, and because you've loved me and have believed that I came out from God. And so the point I'm getting at here is that right now we have learned that we can pray to the Father in Christ's name, but in that day we will ask the Father ourselves. We will communicate with him. And I'm suggesting to you, I want us to think about the time that will come when we will be able to embrace him, hug him, speak to him, thank him. And it'll be personal, it'll be intimate, it'll be experiential. It won't be just looking and saying, oh yeah, he must love us because he did this, made ribeye. Once born into the family, we'll have that intimate relationship with the Father. But right now, we're like the child in the womb. We see through a glass darkly. I know the child can see, images, can see light coming through the flesh. And I know my son, when I played in a band once, that we would go, a little church band, and my son was in the womb, and he would be rocking out. He could hear the sounds, but they're muffled, do you understand? But he could feel the beat. He could feel the beat. But he didn't know about a band. He didn't know what was going on all around him. Psalm 16, child inside the womb knows nothing of the world it's going to be born into. It knows nothing of that. It doesn't know it's going to breathe air. It doesn't know what the world is like that it's going to see. The baby has no idea how big the universe is. It has no idea of galaxies that are out there. It doesn't know about the mountains and what's in them. It doesn't know about the valleys or the streams. It doesn't know about any of this. It has no idea that one day he'll be able to have a computer, that he'll be able to go to libraries, that he'll be able to write books, that there's space travel. The baby has no idea what it's going to be born into. And that's what I tell you today. Look how much he loves us in the creation. Do you have any way, is there any way we could grasp how we don't know and it's going to be so much greater when we're born again? To see the love of the Father in person, individually, to feel it, to experience it? That is what the goal is. That's where we're headed. That's our calling. And it's just awesome, I think. Can you imagine this? Born again, experience God's realm, see the Father in person, see the angels, see the glorious New Jerusalem. You know, experience God's love personally and intimately and individually. We will experience the things that God has prepared for those that love Him that we could not understand now, even if it was told to us, because we're inside. There's a life form inside us that is developing. So he'll shower us with his love and his mercy. Psalm 16, verse 11, you'll show me the path of life, and thy presence is fullness of joy. And at your right hand there are pleasures forevermore. Can you imagine that? Unending pleasures, exciting things to do, jobs and responsibilities and experiences. Well, John 4 again, John 4, if you will. There's no greater love than what the Father has for us in heaven. Imagine the joy when we will embrace Him individually and personally and display love openly. And we fully understand, we will fully understand and fully experience the love of God. So until then, I'm asking us to understand by the creation what He has made for us and see His love for us, and that we'll grasp it, and that once we do grasp it, John, 1 John 4, verse 11, beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. Doesn't that make sense? Doesn't that make perfect sense? If we are going to experience the love of God, then how can we do that if we don't experience love now? You understand my point? Listen to what we read, the very first scripture we read. I want you to listen to it now slowly, thoughtfully, and understand. 1 John 4:8, he that loves not knows not God, for God is love. And so my point today is this, is that look at the love that God has for us. Strive to understand it, but strive to reflect it. We've got to be a people of love to exist in His world of love. Do you see how important that is, that we don't badmouth one another? We don't attack one another. We don't attack others. We don't gossip. We don't tell stories about other people. We love other people, and we want to treat them the way that we would want them to treat us. That is the love of God, shed abroad in our hearts and then spread in the lives of others through us. And that's our calling too. No greater love